to interview atom bomb survivors. He's been studying how nuclear weapons are radically altering our lives. That was the subject of his book, Indefensible Weapons, The Political and Psychological Case Against Nuclearism. You may remember a couple of years ago, we broadcast a series of Lifton's lectures adapted from that book. How Vietnam veterans were transformed by the war is the subject of his book, Home from the War. For the past 9 years, Lifton has been researching the nature of the human capacity for evil and sadism. He's conducted interviews with former Nazi doctors and with their surviving victims. His forthcoming book on the subject is called The Nazi Doctors, Medical Killing and the Psychology of Genocide. It will be published in October by Basic Books, which recently brought out new editions of his books on Hiroshima survivors and Vietnam veterans. Lifton is a peace activist and a board member of the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's in Philadelphia to address the national meeting of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which is currently in progress at the Hershey Hotel. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Glad to be here.
You've written that in every age, man faces a pervasive theme that's difficult to confront but has to be confronted. You said that in Freud's time it was sexuality and moralism, and now it's unlimited technological violence and absurd death. Can you explain that?
Well, that's a way of saying that we're children of our history in what we study, what we feel, and the way we go about studying it. And I think that in all of our minds there is this image or shadow of annihilation. And that brings us, those of us who are scholars, to this subject more readily. It doesn't mean that it's not universal if we do it well, but it does tend to influence what we study.
You were a psychiatrist in the Korean War. Is that how you first got interested in the idea of the consequences of modern war?
Well, I was a psychiatrist during the Korean War, a very fresh, naive, and new psychiatrist. And my very last assignment was toward interviewing returning prisoners of war who'd been put through a program popularly known as brainwashing or so-called thought reform. And I was involved in interviewing them, trying to understand what had gone on in them. And that got me into so-called extreme situations. That was an extreme situation I studied. And then later, when I went back to Japan, it took me a long time to get to Hiroshima, and things happened in between. But eventually, and that was my next major study, I did get to Hiroshima. By that time, it was the 60s. It's hard to say cause and effect, but that was the sequence of it. I think the military took me to Japan. It wasn't any place I had intended or wished to go to at that time. And I think that being removed from my ordinary habitat, seeing some of the world, some of the war, some of the threats, some of the extremities, got me going on this sequence.
So you don't know what it was exactly that got you to Hiroshima to interview survivors there?
Well, when it comes to Hiroshima, there's another sequence that's probably worth mentioning. In the late 50s, I was at Harvard in my first teaching position, and I also was involved with a small group around David Reisman, who at that time, together with others, was much concerned about peace issues, and that was the period of the early shelter building craze and some strange dialogue that went on in our popular media about whether you're supposed to or should shoot your neighbor when he wants to come into your shelter. And a few of us began to think about what that meant for a society to be asking those questions. There was a small newsletter, Committees of Correspondence, named after the American Revolutionary Newsletter, or committees, really, that we put together. And that interest in nuclear threat was very early. It was both academic and, broadly speaking, social or ethical or even activist at that time. Having had that exposure to early glimmerings of the American peace movement, I was perhaps more inclined to eventually go to Hiroshima when I went back to Japan in the 60s, because I'd been to Japan in the 50s as a military person at the end of the war and the occupation, the end of the occupation of Japan and during the Korean War, and I hadn't gone to Hiroshima then. It took me years later to go there, and I think that in between, that exposure to that issue helped sensitize me.
When you went to Hiroshima, you interviewed many survivors of the atom bomb blast. And one of the things that you found, speaking to so many people, was that they experienced what you gave the name psychic numbing. Can you explain what that
is? Yes. Psychic numbing, very simply, means diminished capacity or inclination to feel. And I heard stories from these people that were very vivid and very powerful for me. They would describe how when the bomb fell, they could see things going on around them, horrible, grotesque scenes of people dying, and suddenly they ceased to feel, underwent what one called a paralysis of the mind, a sudden experience of emotions not getting through, and I recognized that eventually as a defense mechanism quite necessary to them. There are terms that are used in psychoanalysis like suppression or repression or isolation or denial, but I wanted a single term for overall muting of feeling, and so I chose the term psychic numbing. And one thing I might add, I had a lesson in terms of my own reaction, because at that time when I first began the interviews, and I wrote about this in the introduction to my book on Hiroshima, well, the first few days, those interviews were overwhelming, and I felt very anxious, and I wondered whether I could stay and do the study. But after a few days, I found that rather suddenly I ceased to be quite as anxious. I was still troubled by what I heard, but I found myself able to focus on themes or common themes and responses, taking on the task of the research investigator. And I later recognized this as what I came to call selective professional numbing. It's kind of putting a good light on it because, after all, I needed the numbing in order to do the study, but I also came to recognize it's a sort of danger that we undergo as professionals in order not to feel too much.
Were you prepared for the stories that you heard? You were, you know, pretty well informed by the time you went. You already lived in Japan for several years. Were you prepared for those actual firsthand accounts when you heard them?
Not at all. It's true I lived in Japan. It's even true that when I first went to Hiroshima in the early spring of 1962, I first talked to a lot of people in the city in general terms and informally in order to get a sense of things and to be introduced to those who could help me in the work about all sorts of things concerning the Hiroshima experience. And that should have prepared me, one might think, for the interviews themselves. But as soon as I began to do the actual interviews, everything changed. They were on a different, more primal level of human experience. They were disturbing. I wasn't prepared for that level of experience. And in a general way, one is never prepared for that level of killing and dying, even as an investigator, and less so even as, of course, a victim.
There was a phenomenon that you described as death in life. Would you describe that?
Well, when I did the study, I found that from that one split second of exposure to that first weapon in Hiroshima, one underwent what I called a lifelong immersion in death. It could be described in several phases, in about four phases. For instance, at the time the bomb fell, those scenes of grotesque dying around one, and then subsequent, really within days or weeks, experience witnessing or actually experiencing oneself the acute symptoms of radiation, and they were grotesque and they involved bleeding into the skin and really through all the bodily orifices and great weakness and many deaths. And then over months and even years, the discovery really 3 years later that rates of leukemia had increased among those significantly exposed and eventually rates of most of the common cancers. And then finally, some sense of being in the process permanently, what I call the identity of the dead, in which one felt oneself bound to the dead as if dead. So because of this permanent immersion in death, and it incidentally extends beyond one's own life since one fears after effects, transmission of genetic effects to subsequent generations, because of this continuous encounter with death and internalization of that death imagery, I called the book Death in Life. I later recognized, I didn't quite realize it at the time, it's a phrase that's been used by Wordsworth and other poets earlier on, but it seemed entirely appropriate for what I was encountering and describing.
Do you think that those of us now, all of us who live in the presence of nuclear weapons, experience to some degree some of the phenomena that you've discussed that the people who survived the actual nuclear blast experienced?
We're not survivors in the direct sense that they were or are, and yet we have certain encounters with nuclear threat that have some bearing on their experience, or their experience has bearing on what we experience. I would characterize our own experience now as a kind of double life, and I've written about this. That is, On the one hand, we know that we could be annihilated in a split second. Everything could be destroyed, everybody and everything we've ever touched or loved. On the other hand, we go about business as usual, as though no such threat existed. And that's the double life. We don't have those searing memories as compared to actual Hiroshima survivors. And in that sense, the threat is odd because it's on the one hand amorphous and in some ways distanced. And on the other hand, it's very absolute. It's one reason why it's so confusing, and there's even a certain amount of controversy about how much it affects us psychologically. And some people have gone so far as to say, quite wrongly, I think, that the effects are not significant. The effects are significant, but they're confusing in their nature.
Do you think that we play certain psychological tricks on ourselves so that we could not think about the fact that there are weapons that could destroy us and the whole Earth?
Inevitably. And, you know, one has to start with a little sympathy for us in playing these tricks, though one doesn't condone it because, you know, who wants to think about nuclear weapons all the time? I think about them, I suppose, more than most people because they're so integral to my life and to my work. Nonetheless, it's very important for me to get them off my mind a lot of the time. I can't think about them 24 hours a day. We go in and out of them inevitably. But in addition to that, we bring a numbing process of our own, an impulse toward diminished or muted feelings. It's partly because the subject is so unpleasant and so threatening, but the numbing also is related to the absence of any kind of experience that might connect us with what nuclear weapons do. It's on such a scale that we have no prior images or models that would in some ways provide a way of looking at or feeling what nuclear weapons would do to us.
Well, when you start thinking about nuclear weapons, when you get in a more paranoid state about it, you can start thinking of the concept of futurelessness, that, well, maybe you won't live to your retirement, or maybe your children won't grow up or something. What are some of, do you think that there are any cultural patterns that you could see now that are based on that kind of fear of futurelessness?
I think that the fear of futurelessness is very much with us. And yes, you find, if not clear-cut cultural patterns, you find, I think, really more in the way of hints rather than clear patterns. If you talk to children, they're likely to say, and you ask them what they want to do when they grow up, and they'll say, well, I'd like to become a doctor, or I'd like to have a lot of children, or I'd like to be a writer, or whatever they would like to be. And then they're likely to add, well, of course, if I do have a chance to grow up. It's, again, another version of the double life, which is very marked and poignant in children or in adolescents. I think that there is a shadow cast over every long-term endeavor. Again, it's kind of contradictory. Of course, we seek prolonged involvements and lasting relationships. We need them. On the other hand, we have some sort of inner doubt about whether they'll ever be realized or whether they will sustain themselves as opposed to some kind of nuclear disaster, a Holocaust interrupting everything. That gives us some doubt about every long-term enterprise. It could indeed contribute to short-term goals and impatience with long-term commitments, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that we can find a clear-cut tendency to resist them. Rather, I think we make the long-term commitments but have doubts about them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Robert J. Lifton, a psychiatrist who's been studying the impact of psychological weapons and of other very unusual characteristics of our era.
He's not the psychological weapons, but the physical weapons on
our psychological
lives.
Thank you. He's in Philadelphia to speak at the National Conference of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and he's on the board of directors of that group. You know, a lot of us experienced in the 1950s, the shelter drills in school, where the principal would come in and say, take cover, and you'd have to get under your desk with your head away from the window. It seemed even like a joke at the time. I don't think we took it very seriously, but I can't help but wonder what long-range repercussions things like that actually have on you.
Yes. Well, I was very pleased one day some years ago when a bright young writer came to see me. His name is Michael Carey, and he said, you know, I'd like to do a study of those drills that I went through. He went through them, I guess, in Alaska where he grew up. But they were they existed all through the United States. And it was through reading my Hiroshima book that he had the idea of doing a study of what those drills were in terms of their psychological effects on people who went through them, we seem to be limitless in our capacity for self-deception. So that, yes, those drills, you know, in a way, in retrospect, of course, they're absurd. A kid is told, well, the tone of them was, you know, the weapons are big, have big explosions, they can destroy a lot of things, but with American know-how and cooperation, we can make our way through. And what's that know-how and cooperation? Well, don't look up at the weapon because it might be bad for your eyes, and put a piece of paper or a book or something over your head to protect yourself from fallout. The kids are, of course, too smart to really believe that literally. On the other hand, their teachers, their authorities were telling them that. So I think the kids came out, and this is now shown in some of the work that Michael Carey has actually done, part of which he's published in educational journals and in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. They moved into areas of absurdity and contradiction, both believing and not believing these things, and they've carried them with them. The most unhealthy response was to identify with the weapon itself and with its power. Some of them did that. But more typically, there was this mixture of half-belief, disbelief, absurdity, some nightmares that many of them had for a while, and then a kind of message which they responded to that you're not supposed to be anxious, you're not supposed to feel anything too much, and so a kind of self-imposed or culturally imposed psychic numbing toward the whole thing, except the mind doesn't always obey cultural orders, and so they went on having nightmares, and in most of them, just Carey bringing up the subject, or from any kind of other reminder, such as testing somewhere, something on that order, they can have a reactivation, what I call symbolic reactivation, of nightmares, fears of the whole experience.
What do you think, after years of the majority of Americans basically disassociating themselves from the arms race, that there was in the 70s and in the 80s an anti-nuclear movement and a very heightened awareness of living with nuclear weapons? What happened? What changed? Is there a difference between now and then that you can see that's responsible for that organizing?
Well, when that sort of thing occurs, a really major shift, and I agree with you, it was that historically or culturally, we never really can predict it. We have lots of retrospective ideas and theories, and we're pretty good at that. But the answer is we don't really know. I don't really know. I don't think anybody else does know exactly how and why it occurred. There are some things that are said, and they have partial truth, I think. The administration began talking about limited nuclear war, and more people got frightened, and there was no evidence of arms control or of any sort of agreement with the Soviets. People got very frightened at some of the rhetoric used in high places. But I don't think that really explains what happened. I think it took a period of time. It takes a period of time to absorb this extraordinary new dimension of human involvement with nuclear threat. And I also think that something began to germinate in the collective human psyche, which I think of as a collective revulsion and even a collective rebellion of the human mind against a kind of fate of Armageddon, an imposed fate of simply going down the path to Armageddon, which we sense to be in store for us if we maintain the nuclear arms race. That plus the increasing effectiveness of certain peace movement groups, everything coming together. I don't think there's any one kind of reason or answer to that question. I think it has something to do with something rather primal along those lines, though.
I wonder if you have spoken to politicians at all about the arms race, because I could see you thinking that they were really missing the point of nuclear weapons, and them thinking that, oh, well, here he is, a psychiatrist. What does he know about weapons? He's really missing the point. Has that kind of thing happened?
Well, I've talked to politicians, and I've testified before congressional groups. Usually the groups that ask me to testify are sympathetic to my message. But I do understand that there are a lot of political leaders and nuclear strategists who would, and increasingly there is the possibility of dialogue now between the likes of me and the likes of them. And there's a young psychologist, Stephen Cole, who's speaking at the meeting, the PSR meeting, who has actually interviewed these nuclear strategists. In other words, the issue of dialogue is now open, partly because with nuclear winter, we have a shared image of what the weapons really do. In a way, the things that we in the physicians' movement have been saying for some time, you can't survive the weapons and you can't have any medical response, not because we wouldn't want to, but because the weapons make that impossible. Nuclear winter confirms that. So we have common ground with nuclear strategists who may be more hawkish. They may say, well, we need all these weapons for keeping the peace or for detente or for, nuclear deterrence. I think that's wrong, but they can try to make that argument. But at least the argument can be made and we can talk to one another from a certain amount of common ground.
A new weapon system that's entering the arena of debate on nuclear weapons is Star Wars, and it has been pitched by the President of the United States as an opportunity to do away with nuclear weapons because it would be this shield, this ultimate shield against nuclear weapons, and it would make nuclear war obsolete. How do you think the development of the Star Wars debate has affected the psychological impact of the nuclear weapons debate?
Well, Star Wars is a very strange phenomenon. Maybe it was inevitable. I would see it as the ultimate nuclear age illusion. We've had a series of illusions about recovery and illusions about preparation, illusions about rebuilding. I've written about them, and I think their illusory nature has increasingly been recognized. That's why people laugh and make jokes about civil defense and so on, both the Soviets and the American people with their folk wisdom, and Soviets also. And now along comes Star Wars with a kind of grand illusion. And the grand illusion, very simply, is a denial, a rejection of the fundamental truth of the nuclear age, and that is vulnerability. Total, universal vulnerability. That's what the weapons create. Nobody wants to be vulnerable. In this sense, the president, in promoting Star Wars, is on the one hand retaining the arms race, because Star Wars is part of the arms race. If you build that kind of shield and the other side builds weapons that can go through the shield, and then the first side builds more of the shield, and it's an endless process. On the other hand, a side of the president would like to be a peacemaker. You know, if you're along in years and in your second administration, your only constituents are God and history, and that's true for any president. And the president would like to go down in history as a peacemaker. I know he would. And that's the other side of Star Wars. Unfortunately, there are contradictions about Star Wars, and there is that side of it, and that's one reason why Star Wars has assumed so much significance. But I think we who evaluate this have to look at the contradiction, recognize that now the president and people around him are talking about the scourge of nuclear weapons and getting rid of them, really join them in that terminology which we initiated, the critics of nuclear weapons, take them to task on it while revealing the contradictions in Star Wars itself.
There's different levels that you can enter into the weapons debate on. One level is a kind of emotional level of, well, it is very frightening to live with these weapons. How can we rely on our security on weapons that are going to perhaps kill us? But the other level is the armed strategist level, in which you talk about so many cruise missiles and so many of these missiles and those and deployment and land-based and submarine-based and so on. And that's a very complicated high-tech language that laymen don't really know. And I wonder what you think of the language of the debate.
The language of the debate is part of the problem, because on the one hand, it's quite true that people who enter into the debate and who try to take a stand, and I mean ordinary citizens as well as those who work at it in some way professionally, we should, of course, learn about what the threat is, learn something about the nature of the threat, and that means learning a minimum about the nature of the weapons. Still, much of the rhetoric is a form of mystification. It's rendered more complex and convoluted than it need be. I think also the language is detoxifying. And here I think I hold the nuclear strategists and many government leaders responsible, but the rest of us also, for acceding to this. If you talk about nuclear strikes or nuclear exchange, as I wrote, a nuclear exchange sounds like something good. It sounds like gift giving. You know, I exchange, you give me something, I give you something back, rather than the total annihilation of the species. So the language is detoxifying, and then there's a kind of disembodied game that's played in which it's like a chess game rather than involving millions of human corpses. So the language is part of the problem.
You've written that one way for individuals to overcome the psychic numbing of living in the nuclear age is to believe in the future and to take some kind of action that will reaffirm your belief in the future. But what do you think meaningful action is to take, meaningful action to prevent the outbreak of a nuclear war?
Well, the first point to make, I think, is that it sounds, of course, grim to confront the whole thing. You know, one could be much happier with SEEM just ignoring it, staying away from it. But really, if you confront the issue, it's with some relief because you do a lot of psychological work to fend it off. And most of us have some sense if we're not doing anything, we should be doing something. And we're a little uneasy in our stance of resisting it or numbing ourselves to it. I think in terms of action people should take, confrontation with the issue is the first action. That's political, psychological, ethical. But then I think one has to take different forms of action. We in the physicians movement make our task that of education primarily, really making known what the weapons are, what they do, and some of the many concomitants or issues that are involved. In my case, the psychological issues. People can join like-minded people from where they are, students working with students, faculty with faculty, working people with working people. And they can also join people geographically near in terms of, and this involves everything from the vote and who one puts in office, it's the ultimate question of our time, to groups that are outside of the electoral process and that are either educational or more militant at every possible level. There's no one thing to do to diminish the danger of nuclear war. There are many different things. It's one issue in which education, well done and done in a committed way, has enormous value of a political and ethical kind. And I think the education and the commitment and the joining together has to be toward carefully arranged treatments, agreements, toward diminishing nuclear stockpiles in significant numbers, getting rid of the weapons, because otherwise we're all in danger, and we're in danger as a civilization and as a species.
My guest is psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, and he's in Philadelphia to address the National Convention of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's also written many books on nuclear weapons and on, his new forthcoming book is on the Nazi doctors in the concentration camps, and that book is scheduled to come out in October. You've been spending the past 7 years or 9 years researching the doctors who worked in the Nazi death camps.
Feels like forever. It wasn't only doctors who worked in Nazi death camps, but it was Nazi doctors in general, with a certain focus on Auschwitz. But I studied Nazi doctors, some of whom were involved in other malignant activities, including killing of mental patients or so-called euthanasia, which one has to put in quotes. But anyhow, and some of whom were involved in kind of Nazifying medicine administratively and ideologically, but I did study a whole group of Nazi doctors and I focused on Auschwitz.
The most, I think, commonly asked question about the Nazi doctors and people like Joseph Mengele is how can a human being do that? You've studied the men who actually performed the sadistic experiments and helped figure out how to efficiently kill lots of people quickly. Do you think it takes a special kind of human being to perform sadistic deaths and mass murders?
Well, I'd put it this way. In the case of Mengele, and I wrote an article about Mengele, really it came from my book that was published a few months ago in the New York Times Magazine. And Mengele, of course, was not an ordinary individual. He was one of the more sadistic Nazi doctors, and he was also an ideological fanatic. Yet even Mengele, with those traits, would probably not have killed anyone were it not for the Nazi movement, and hadn't killed anybody, as far as we know, until he got to Auschwitz. My point there is that certain kinds of ideologies and certain kinds of structures or institutions like Auschwitz that are geared toward killing can release and bring out and magnify, welcome the potential sadism and sense of omnipotence and even paranoia in certain kinds of people. But most of the Nazi doctors whom I interviewed were very ordinary. They weren't especially sadistic, and they weren't even especially extreme ideologues, although they certainly had some of the Nazi ideology. So rather ordinary people given certain ideological developments, people who start out as ordinary, once they do what they did, they were no longer ordinary, but people who start out as rather ordinary can move into doing some very extraordinary and murderous things.
Is there a connection between the work you've been doing on nuclear weapons and the research that you're conducting into Nazi doctors?
Well, there are connections one could make, and one has to make them carefully. In my work with Nazi doctors, when I came to ask myself the question you asked me, how could they do what they did, the ideology and various Nazi attractions and pressures could lead them very far indeed. But there was a mechanism I came to describe that I call doubling. And by doubling, I mean the formation of a second self, a kind of second self of a person that's rather autonomous, rather separate from the original self. In the case of Nazi doctors, they could form what I called an Auschwitz self. And the Auschwitz self could adapt to the whole killing process, while the prior self was relatively more humane, an ordinary doctor, neither better nor worse than most other men. And that capacity for doubling in murderous environments, I think, is part of the human repertoire. It's something that almost anybody's capable of if the conditions take on certain characteristics. If we look at the nuclear weapons scene, although people involved with nuclear weapons are not Nazi doctors, they don't subscribe to evil ideologies, which the Nazi doctors did. Nonetheless, one can find a parallel process of doubling, the formation of a second self in many people, which could be called a nuclear weapons self. And with that self, one can imagine using the weapons, building them, possibly limited nuclear war, killing only a few million, all of those draconian projections that some nuclear strategists have made. That same nuclear strategist may be, in most of his life, a very decent person, quite kind and loving toward wife and children and so on. And to that extent, one can find a parallel in that doubling process. And that idea has been, in my judgment, more or less confirmed by some of the work done recently by Stephen Cull, a psychologist who has been interviewing nuclear strategists.
Can you explain what the role was of Nazi doctors in the death camp and in Nazi Germany?
Well, in a death camp, in Auschwitz, for instance, which I studied especially, and I interviewed a lot of survivors as well as a few Nazi doctors who had been there, what is not appreciated, I mean, it's known that they did all sorts of experiments, some of them fatal, and they were brutal and quite horrible enough. But what is a little less known is that they were actually in charge of the killing process in Auschwitz. They did selections at the ramp, which meant selecting a minority of incoming Jews to go into the camp and work and live at least for a period of time, and selecting a majority of the arrivals, usually up to 70 or 80 or even 90% for the gas chambers. They also selected people within the camp and in the medical blocks, allowing some to live and the weaker ones usually to be sent to the gas chambers, so that they were trying to maintain a relatively intact or relatively healthy, by Auschwitz standards, group of prisoners for the workforce working for IG Farben and for the Nazi war effort. They also would drive to the gas chamber when they did the large selections for people at the railway track where they came to the camp. They would drive to the gas chamber together with an assistant and the actual gas pellets. And the assistant would put the pellets in. The Nazi doctor would be the overall supervisor, even though it became quite routinized, of the process, who had to declare when the gassing was complete and the gas chambers could be open and the process repeated. So in that sense, the doctor was in charge of the whole process, which is a direct reversal of the doctor's healing commitment. That part of the doctor's work in Auschwitz and in parts of Nazi activity is less known.
You spoke to a lot of the doctors. How did they rationalize using their medical skills for committing murder and for death as opposed to saving people?
They would talk to me about having a kind of step-by-step process by which they saw the pressures on them to be very great, and they tried to see themselves as in some way making the best of a bad situation. It wasn't the way that I accepted their explanation, but they wanted to present themselves that way to me. They would describe how if someone else selected, if it weren't for doctors, then they might select still more people for the gas chamber and say fewer. And they saw themselves as not having created the Nazi system, but of having been caught up in it. That's the way they wanted to describe themselves. Of course, they were left with uneasiness about what they did, and they underwent themselves extreme numbing and a kind of withdrawal. They didn't like to confront the issue. When you look into this kind of thing systematically, as I tried to do over these years, you find out that relatively ordinary people can slide into situations, or even when they are suddenly confronted with situations, as with arriving in Auschwitz, for instance, which was a very major transition for them. No matter how Nazified they'd come before, Auschwitz was still a staggering confrontation for them. Then, unless one makes a clear-cut and definite decision to leave, and they could have done that because they had a certain amount of leverage in the Nazi professional system, the difficulty with that was if they left as they were part of a military unit, the Waffen-SS, they would have been sent to the front in Russia, and there many Germans were being killed. But once they elected not to leave or to stay, there's a tremendous psychological impulse toward adapting, toward reverting from what one Nazi doctor described to me as from being an outsider to an insider. And they then unconsciously and preconsciously and quite consciously to an extent move into that transition process of adaptation and gradually do what one is supposed to do as the Auschwitz self is formed and takes hold. And they find themselves doing these things. Now, many German doctors committed suicide at the end of World War II. Probably a larger number of doctors relatively than other professionals, though it's very hard to have exact statistics. It wasn't entirely out of pure conscience because they were also quite aware that they had no future and probably would have been tried and convicted and given the death penalty as things were at that time. Nonetheless, I think there is the sense that the transgression was greatest in doctors because only they take an oath of healing among the professionals.
For the doctors who did survive and didn't take their life after the war, the ones that you interviewed, was there any feeling of remorse?
Unfortunately, very little. A very great German physician who was an anti-Nazi doctor and then became a psychoanalyst who wrote about these things, Alexander Mitscherlich. He died a few years ago, but I became quite friendly with him and talked with him about his work. When we talked about the Nazis in general, he said, what they did, and he meant his own generation, the ones who led the Nazi movement, what they did was so evil and so horrendous that they couldn't touch it in terms of a sense of guilt. And I found that to be true. I found virtually no sense of remorse. What these doctors did in their interviews with me, they were surprisingly open and spoke rather freely once we made the appointment, and they did come and saw me, did come and see me. But they spoke as though they were a third person, as though it weren't they. It wasn't that particular individual who was talking to me who had been there that he was talking about. That was their way of both describing their experiences and what they did, and yet not confronting them and avoiding that dimension of remorse. It wasn't a satisfying experience for me morally in that sense, though of course it was valuable psychologically.
Part of the doubling process again?
Very much part of the doubling process. When they went back to being ordinary German physicians after the war, and there was a surprising kind of process in which first they were ordinary doctors, then they became Nazi doctors, and then they became ordinary doctors again. Now, that's oversimplified. They had certain residual effects, but one could all too readily make those shifts, and it shows the enormous impact of a powerful environment on human behavior. And then, of course, they tried to revert to a kind of post-war self, and that post-war self wanted to reject the Nazi self, but their reversion or their development of a post-war self was incomplete because really, to develop it fully, they would have had to have confronted the Nazi self even if they wanted to relieve themselves of it. And so they never did that really thoroughly, and they were caught in between various elements of both selves, though they tried to move out of the Nazi self.
I think in a way we want to find out that Nazi doctors and SS leaders were beasts and were really different than us. And that way we know that we and our friends and our family and Americans are just incapable of turning into that. But that's not what you're finding.
Not at all. And I think, you know, if we can look at the truth in a way, we can take better and more constructive action in regard to our own problems. There's one Auschwitz survivor who, you know, had seen some of those Nazi doctors, and he's a very sensitive man, a gifted person. And he said to me after I had begun the work, tell me, when they did what they did, were they men or were they demons? And I said to him, well, of course, they were men, and that's why I went to study them. He said, but it is demonic that they were not demonic. Well, of course, they became demonic in what they did, but he was saying what you just said as well. One would expect appropriately, given the atrocious things that they did, that they would be demonic in essence in order to be able to do them, rather than very ordinary men who became corrupted and then did demonic things, ordinary people moving into demonic acts, as opposed to being inherently evil or demonic, which most of them indeed were not. And that, of course, brings it closer to home. It means that we're not inherently evil, I mean human beings in general, in my view. Rather, we have the capacity for good or evil, and we become what we are, through our own personal decisions.
Was this especially difficult research for you to do as a Jew?
It was very painful for me. I think it would be very painful for anybody to do, but perhaps especially so as a Jew, because after all, I was sitting there talking to people who were part of a movement who wanted to victimize my people and me, essentially, and everybody else, really, who didn't agree with them or even some who did. And I was sustained through it by, I thought about this later, what got me through it, because I did get through it and I had energy for doing it, partly by the sense that I had this project of my own. I would have my say in my book. And partly, and this is interesting and important to me, by a network of Germans whom I became friendly with. They were mostly anti-Nazi, non-Jewish Germans who I'd been introduced to either in the United States or Germany through friends, and they were very committed to what I was doing and helped me in marvelous ways and helped me sustain the work in every way they could. And that gave me the sense of a different Germany and of a different German possibility, which was very important to me in my psychological well-being.
My guest is psychiatrist Dr. Robert J. Lifton. Sometimes I think we're really just obsessed with death and with mass death, because we're confronting the aftereffects of the Nazi death camps, the possibility of nuclear war, the fact of the two nuclear bombs that have already been dropped on Japan. And then there's the famine in Ethiopia. There's chemical catastrophes like what happened in Bhopal. And I wonder if you think that there is this obsession with mass death now.
Well, from the examples you gave, you have to first look at what's happening in our century, what's happening now in the latter part of the 20th century. It looks like a lot of death or threat of death on a mass scale. And in that sense, a lot of the obsession with death has a certain amount of appropriateness. The death is everywhere, or its potential. And how can we react otherwise? In terms of the Holocaust of the recent past, the Nazi Holocaust on the one hand, and the first use of atomic or nuclear weapons in Japan on the other, well, these are events of the relatively recent past, and they have shaken us up in terms of some threshold they've gone over. And we know of other related apocalyptic possibilities in terms of environmental destruction and so on. So it's our very technology that inundates us with either death or the possibility of death, along with some evil actions in connection with that technology. That is the starting point, it seems to me, for looking at some of the obsession with death that you mentioned.
Well, there are made-for-TV movies about Hitler and about the Holocaust and about atom bombs. And on the one hand, you could say, well, that's really great because it keeps before the public these terrible Holocausts and, you know, we need to remember them and so on. On the other hand, it can become, I think, almost voyeuristic to, like a monster movie or something, to just watch the destruction of a city or watch people die. And I wonder if you think that movies like that end up sensitizing us or numbing us.
I wouldn't make a general statement about the one or the other. Usually the pattern is something like this. There is in the case of these two major events, the two nuclear bombings and the Nazi Holocaust, First, there's a tremendous silence, a loud silence for a long period of time. That is, there's a kind of recoil from the whole experience and profound numbing. Eventually, there are expressions of breakthrough, and sometimes sensitive individuals lead the way in what they write or describe or visualize or certain films. For instance, Night and Fog was a great film about the Holocaust, there have been some powerful statements made about nuclear weapons, often many years later. And then, perhaps more in America than elsewhere, though everywhere to an extent, the culture seizes upon this. It becomes almost faddist, as you say, and it replays it over and over again, but often in exploitative ways and in ways that trivialize the event. In that sense, the value of taking up the event depends upon the quality of the confrontation. It can go either way. I think by and large it must be taken up, and that's why one needs a certain amount of patience with the media. I defended The Day After, for instance, which was not a very great film in terms of filmic, you know, qualities. It was very bad in some ways, and it had stick figures mostly. Nonetheless, it had a certain power, and it took a certain amount of courage, or at least breakthrough, to have a film shown that way on a major network at prime time and so on. And it had some usefulness, I think, for nuclear consciousness and the culture, considerable usefulness. Threads was a much better film. Threads was seen much less widely, but nonetheless, it was a more sensitive film, and I admired it enormously, though we felt the need to accompany it, we being various peace movement groups and physicians groups, accompany it with elements of hope because the film was so painful and could leave one with a sense of hopelessness that we didn't want to leave people with because we don't feel that way. Nonetheless, there are other things that are less noble that are done. There are all kinds of more grade C or Z films made. They become exploitative. They take a real issue and they exploit it the way violence is exploited all through the media. In that sense, the judgment really depends upon artistic and moral quality of the work done. But I'm not one of those people who says, oh, we have to get rid of violence completely on the media. Violence is bad for the children. Well, the children are in the world with us. The children are threatened by violence. They feel the violence of nuclear threat and of other kinds of events in the society. So we can't just proscribe violence, eliminate it by fiat. Rather, we need to confront it, and the children need some way to imagine the problem of violence within an ethical context in which the film or the work of art has some ethical position taken by its author or maker, so to speak. And that's more solid or more sensitive work of the kind that we need.
A phenomenon I've noticed in the past 8 or 10 years is that many books have been published lately that are almost scrapbooks of the Holocaust during World War II. You know, photos of death camps or reproductions of art from death camps coupled with survivor stories. And after a while, you almost say to yourself, why is there another scrapbook of the Holocaust? And I'd just really like to hear how you react to that and if you think that in our need to remember things like that, we perhaps sometimes take inappropriate or too many actions.
It's very hard to say who the we is in this sense because there's so many different subgroups within the culture. But I understand what you mean. I start out with a certain sympathy for any survivor who wants to record and feels a need to record her or his experience. And that need has to do with what could be called, what I call survivor meaning, the need of the survivor of any situation to give some significance, some inner form to what is otherwise a devastating and unacceptable kind of event in order to have some form and meaning in, again, her or his future life. And that kind of survivor account can be in the service of that. I also have sympathy for the insistence on the part of survivors that we all remember. It happened. There's so much of a tendency to resist the idea that it happened because it's so incredulous. We are so incredulous before something that seems so extraordinary and so unlikely. And of course, there are groups that try systematically to falsify or deny the Holocaust. On the other hand, I understand what you're saying. We don't want to just be inundated by horror and fear. And here I'd say the key issue is finding some significance in the Holocaust, now I'm talking about the Nazi Holocaust, that is useful to us today. In that sense, the events of the past are not simply the past. They have to do with the present and the future. And I mean not only Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also Auschwitz and Treblinka. There are things we can learn from the Nazi Holocaust, and indeed I'm working on a book now together with a younger colleague in which we are going to try to take some of the lessons from the Nazi Holocaust and see what their relevance might be for our present set of nuclear weapons dilemmas and for nuclear threat in general. And I think there's lots of relevance if one puts it very carefully and rigorously. And it's in that spirit that I think we want to study the Holocaust rather than with any idea of simply immersing ourselves in horror.
You have been studying war and Holocaust for years now. And I wonder what you have to do in your own life so that your life isn't just covered over with the pall of death.
Well, yes, I immerse myself in these things. I'm not really a depressed person. I think that when you immerse yourself in these issues, you need lots of love around you, and you need expressions that are very free and very free of these issues. I'm very drawn to poetry, all the more so in terms of my involvement in such matters. I'm also a fanatical tennis player, and that can do a lot for one. I think that there's a certain relief, though, in confronting these issues. In my case, I do it as part of my creative struggles, and that also makes it more possible. And by confronting these issues and having something to say, however inadequate anything we say on it one knows to be, nonetheless, by attempting that confrontation, one feels a certain relief and a certain beginning contribution to cultural knowledge, and that helps a great deal in one's own psychic existence.
I know some people who are involved with very difficult positions, whether it has to do with healing or it has to do with the kind of work you're doing, researching, interviewing people who've been survivors of Holocausts, that there's this temptation to not allow yourself to have a good time because it doesn't seem fair in the light of what you've witnessed through the people who you're working with. And do you think that's an unhealthy attitude to take?
Well, I think it's very understandable that, for instance, it is an attitude of survivors themselves. Sometimes it's quite unconscious. There's the feeling of having to live what I call a survivor half-life, a kind of discomfort or even sense of guilt that one has survived and others have died. Now, one can transfuse or transform that sense of guilt into a sense of responsibility and commitment or a sense of witness, as most survivors do. But sometimes that can linger on the feeling that one doesn't have a right to joy or pleasure because people so close to one died and one has been so close to that as a witness. I myself think that one needs those pleasures, one needs joy in every way and every occasion and every fashion one can have it. And actually, many people who are deeply committed to these issues can be joyous and are joyous. We see this in groups who do work on them and who work on nuclear weapons issues because they are confronting the issues and, in a way, liberate their minds from resistance to confronting them and have a little bit more openness to joy.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome.
My guest has been Dr. Robert J. Lifton. He's a psychiatrist who has been studying extreme circumstances, like studying survivors of the nuclear holocaust and of the atomic bomb blasts in Japan. His new book is going to examine the psychology of the Nazi doctors. And that book is called The Nazi Doctors. It will be published in October by Basic Books. And that company has recently reissued several of Robert J. Lifton's books, including Death and Life, which is his study of Hiroshima survivors, Home from the War, which is his study of veterans who survived the Vietnam War, and his book Indefensible Weapons, about the psychological impact of living with nuclear weapons, is also still in print. Dr. Lifton is on the board of directors of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and he's in Philadelphia today to address their national meeting, which is currently in progress at the Hershey Hotel. Thank you again for being with us. It's 5 minutes to four. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Coming up in just about 5 minutes on Fresh Air, my guest will be Reverend Jerry Falwell, who is a founder of The Moral Majority, and he's a Baptist minister who's based in Lynchburg, Virginia, and we'll be meeting him in just a few minutes on Fresh Air. As you may know, beginning the last Monday in March, we're going to start a new round of the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series, and she's going to have many guests with her for this new round of duets and interviews. So I thought we could listen to Marion McPartland at the piano with singer Teddy King.